Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Have you ever watched a film that's made you want to, like, get fit? Has there ever been, like, a film that's done that to you?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't think there is, really.
Opposite. Maybe you want to be a slob.
I'm sure the time will come. I'm sure there will be a film that makes me want to do that. What about you?
Weirdly enough, the film we're reviewing is the nostalgia pick this month. Fight Club. Now, yeah. I'm not a vain person particularly. I don't particularly think I'm a vain person. However, Brad Pitt's stomach is something that if I could, I don't know, I'd trade a bit for that. I wouldn't mind having his stomach. He does seem to be able to kind of rock something pretty impressive.
It makes you want to cry sometimes, though, doesn't it? You think, I'd like to have a stomach like that, but I know what it entails.
I think the worst thing would be as well, if you could do it, you know, if it was like, yeah, you can have that, but you've got to keep it. You've got to maintain it. That I would lose it, and that would just be even worse. Do you want me to have it, and then to have it taken away?
And take it away. But your thing is, though, Brad Pitt's, what, 58 or 59 now, and he's still kind of got that shape.
Yeah, all right, Brian. I'm in my 30s. And
I'm just saying. I'm just pointing out a basic facts, you know. And it just makes you think, how on earth does he do it? But then again, though, he can afford to have a personal trainer. He can work it out every day. You know, he's probably got his own dietitian, you know, his own body movement coach. You know, we haven't got that sort of thing, have we?
We're just moving on. I haven't any of that. Well, I'll tell you what I do have. Funnily enough, probably the reason why I'll never have a stomach like that. We were contacted by a lovely company called Forest Feast, bless you, Brian, you haven't had any of these, but they did send them to me. They've sent me some snacks for me to try, which are meant to be kind of alternatives to your run-of-the-mill popcorn. Because I don't know about you, I'm not a big fan of popcorn, if I'm honest.
Not huge, really.
I think it's probably the worst kind of snack for a film. Anyway, so they've done kind of these... Well, first off, they're vegan. I don't know if they're all vegan, but the ones they've sent me are vegan, which I'm very happy with because my daughters are egg and milk free. But anyway, we've got chocolate covered raisins, we've got chocolate covered corn, and we've got chocolate covered peanuts.
That sounds nice the way you're describing it, actually.
They are delicious, I must say. They are quite crunchy still, so it's a noisy snack. So I'm not going to eat them on the pod. I was eating them while we tested our mics. But they are really, really nice. I particularly like the raisins. I've always liked chocolate-covered raisins because they are not a noisy snack, so you're not going to annoy someone in the cinema.
I know.
They are really yummy.
A quiet snack is what we need in cinemas.
Yeah. You know, Forest Feast. I recommend them if you can.
Okay, sounds good. I shall make a note of that. I'll make a mental and a physical note of it.
But that's the reason why I don't have a six-pack, is that I'm too drawn to chocolate-covered raisins and not so much to the personal trainers.
Yeah, well, yeah. It's understandable, isn't it? I mean, as I say, we're only human at the end of the day. But it's nice to sort of reach for it, though, Chris. How close you get to it's another matter entirely.
Well, as we've mentioned chocolate, okay, let's do another one. Best scene or best film involving chocolate. Go for it. God.
Oh, God. Oh, God, now you put me on the spot.
So I'll give you mine while you think of yours. Because, yeah, okay. Right, well, first it would either be the Augustus Gloop in Willy Wonka, you know, when he falls in the river of chocolate, because that is pretty, pretty cool. Or it would be the bit from Matilda, the Bruce Bogtrotter bit where he has to eat the cake. I think that is iconic because it's like every child's dream to be told you have to eat the cake. But then when he's doing it, it's like, it's like horrific. But then he gets the spirit of all the kids and they help him do it. And
I reckon the one that most readily springs to mind is Monty Python's Meaning of Life.
Oh, yes.
Mr. Creosote. you know this thing I'm talking about, don't you? Yeah, with Terry Jones and John Cleese is the waiter. And he says, "Our waffle thin mints." No, I can't eat anymore. And that, to me, maybe for all the wrong reasons, it's kind of different from the ones you described, but it's just that kind of, that sense of excess and gluttony that, you know, it's kind of, I know it's inside of me because, you know, I have a, shall we say, a healthy appetite. But I mean, I'm a huge Monty Python fan anyway, but it's just classic Python. And it's kind of triggering a scene and a reaction with just a wafer thin mint. Not a wafer thin, a wafer thin mint. Wafer thin. And I'm presuming that's a chocolate, actually, to be fair. It might not be.
Could be a mint. Yeah, I mean, I think like an after eight or something. They're that sort.
Well, yeah, that's
thin,
what I was
thinking. Thin mint, yeah.
Yeah, thin mint, yeah. So, yeah. Oh, yeah, you've really given me a lot to think about here, Chris.
I know, I'm putting you on the spot today because I think I'm all hopped up on chocolate, if I'm honest. I've eaten two bags so far already. Right, on to the films, Brian. Come on, we can't dilly-dally.
Okay, fair enough.
So, as always, listeners, welcome to UK Film Club. This is where we review all sorts of films, from the cinema releases to the streaming picks. We've got a couple of indie short films on there. And as you've already heard, we're going to review a nostalgia pick, which this week will be Fight Club. I have asked for people's responses to Fight Club, but no one sent them. And I think that might be an internal joke as to the first two rules of Fight Club. Yeah, maybe people are saying don't talk about it. So maybe everyone's playing a trick on me.
Yeah, it could well be, actually. Yeah.
So without further ado, let's start with the cinema releases.
Okay. What? Any particular order you want, Miss Going, or should I just take it as it comes?
I'd like you to go in the order in which they appear in your mind when you think of them in terms of how lovely they are.
Oh, okay. How lovely they are. Do I start with the loveliest first or the least
loveliest? Loveliest first.
All right, the loveliest first.
To the least loveliest.
All right, okay then. Let's go with Air. Now, this is a film directed by Ben Affleck, starring Matt Damon and Ben Affleck, Jason Bateman, Viola Davis. This is the story of how Nike cornered the market for baseball shoes using an up-and-coming Michael Jordan. We're talking about the birth of the legendary Air Jordan boot. Great film. The film of the month, as far as I'm concerned.
Wow.
It's a great piece of storytelling. It's true, and it pins down something very clear in my own memory about when it all happened, when it started. And it also portrays the significance of branding, of image rights. That's where it all started, with Michael Jordan and the Air Jordan. At the time, I mean, don't know how familiar listeners are with the story behind Nike and Air Jordan, but Converse were leading the market in basketball shoes. Adidas were kind of in there, but Nike were lagging behind. Now, Matt Damon plays the marketing man, Sonny Vaccaro, who's responsible for promoting baseball shoes. And it all hinges on what baseball players they can get to promote the boot, right? And they were struggling. And it's all about the time and chance and the opportunities they take. And, of course, Michael Jordan for bootmakers back then was the hot ticket. Everybody wanted Michael Jordan. Straight out of college, he was the hot shot. He was the whiz kid. But, you know, and of course he proved that, but they were all fighting for his signature. And it's all about Sonny Vaccaro, played by Matt Damon, winning the day, talking him around. But the interesting thing about this film, though, is that you hardly see Michael Jordan himself. You see the back of him. You hear him on the phone occasionally. And it's more about the negotiations that take place between Vaccaro and Michael Jordan's mum, Dolores, played by Viola Davis. But cracking film, great film. And you get to see Matt Damon with a beer gut, which is kind of tying in with what we were talking about earlier on. But it might be prosthetic, I don't know. I say that here and now, I'm not absolutely certain, but it looks pretty authentic to me. And I can see that he's worked hard on it as well.
That is the thing. People don't always appreciate how hard it is to gain weight, you know, to put that on. I mean, I make it look effortless, but there's people out there that really, really struggle. But that sounds like a very cool film. I hadn't really heard of this one, if I'm honest, but I do love Affleck. You know, we reviewed Good Will Hunting not long ago.
We did,
And always up for that, any kind of combo with him and Matt Damon, and it sounds right up my street.
Yeah, no, it's a good film, and it works. But one thing that I think is interesting, though, is that to begin with, when it first came out, when on general release, it was getting almost 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. So it was getting a 5-star review almost every time. I found that slightly difficult to believe because whilst it is a very good film, I don't think it's quite that good. And the review that we did on the website by George Wolfe, I think George scored it about right. He gave it 4 stars. But, you know, I'm not saying that it's totally unreasonable to give it 5, but it's not quite a 5-star film. But it's the film of the month for me. It is very, very good. And, of course, you've got a great cast. You're all very watchable. Totally convincing.
Wow. That is lovely. You've gone with your loveliest. So let's have your next loveliest.
My second loveliest. I would go for On a Wing and a Prayer. Now, this is a film that was originally intended for general release, but for sort of legal and licensing reasons, it's gone straight to stream via Amazon Prime. But a very solid film, directed by Sean McNamara, starring Dennis Quaid as Doug White and Heather Graham playing his wife Terry. Now, this is a true story. It actually happened. Basically, to distill the story down, they charter a private plane after attending his brother's funeral, and the pilot has a heart attack, so Doug has to land the plane. He has to take over. He's only had a few flying lessons, so he has to be talked down by a traffic control. Now, this is a story we've heard endlessly, but what gives it an edge is that it is true. And what I liked about it particularly was the basic human quality that he wasn't being a hero. He didn't want to be a hero. He just wanted to get out of it alive. And I like that. I like that approach because, let's face it, this story's been done so many times before. But this isn't a kind of like a professional pilot, like in a Sully or Flight, you know, the big budget films that have been made, dealing with a similar situation where someone has to land a plane in distress. You know, Sully with Tom Hanks and Flight with Denzel Washington. They were professional pilots, true stories, but professional pilots, they knew what they were doing. Right. Doug White didn't have a clue, right? And it was obviously didn't have a clue. And I think some reviews of the film have been a bit snippy and a bit unfair because it is a good film and it works. And I like Dennis Quaid and I like Heather Graham, who kind of faded slightly from the scene. All actors have stars that fade, but it's nice to see them back.
Okay, Brian, sounds like a real treat. Weirdly, you mentioned Tom Hanks because I had a dream the other night and I was in some kind of corporate building. Tom Hanks was there. And you know you can trust Tom Hanks, right? Tom Hanks feels like he's the trustworthy person.
Absolutely.
And I made my way over to him. He's wearing glasses and he's holding some champagne. And he tried to get me to invest in this kind of venture that he was on. And I at first I was kind of, okay, well, of course, yeah, it's Tom Hanks. But after a while, I started to get these really weird vibes from him. And ever since that dream, I felt a bit weird towards Tom Hanks. Nothing to do with him. It's not his fault, but dream Tom Hanks has really unsettled me.
Has it changed your view of him slightly?
I feel like, you know, when I watch Toy Story with my kids, I'm just like, he's a liar, kids. Don't listen to him.
I know. You see, it's funny what it can do, though, isn't it? I mean, did you kind of wake up when the dream wasn't complete?
Mm, yeah.
Did it have a kind of an end?
No, no. I was going down some stairs, and then that's the last thing I remember. But I remember being not happy with Tom, for sure.
Oh, you know, I mean, if it's anyone you'd trust, it'd be Tom Hanks, because he's Mr. Dependable, isn't he, really? In so many ways, that's what he represents. Good.
Best Tom Hanks film?
Oh, that's a tough one.
I love doing this to you. It's so fun.
Philadelphia.
Oh, good choice.
Yeah, Philadelphia.
Very good choice.
Followed by Saving Private Ryan.
But yeah, both up there for me. I still have such a soft spot for Forrest Gump. I think Forrest Gump's a great film. I enjoy that.
I really need to watch it again, because I can remember some films that I watch. You know, I kind of react to films that are hyped, films that get a big introduction. I tend to shy away from it a little bit. And Forrest Gump is that kind of film. Because I kind of mentally shut off and think, right, I'll leave that to one side, because I can't deal with all the attention, all the fuss that it's getting. I want to see it for what it is. But yeah, of course, it's one of those type of films, Forrest Gump, isn't it? That there was someone who happened to be present at every significant event in America in the 20th century. And wouldn't you just like to be able to do that and say, yeah, I was there. Yeah.
No, it's a good one, though.
A good film. Yeah.
So, on A Wing and a Prayer, second loveliest. What's the next lovely film we're going to
third? Well, third loveliest is A Good Person. Now, this is directed by Zach Braff, starring Florence Pugh as Alison and Morgan Freeman as Daniel. Now, the story here, basically, is that Alison seemingly has a perfect life. Good job, engaged to the man of her dreams. Then disaster strikes as Alison is involved in a fatal accident. Her life's spirals out of control. Her relationship ends and resorts to drugs and alcohol. She goes to rehab, and by coincidence, she bumps into Daniel, who would have been her future father-in-law. And they bond, and they slowly begin to rebuild their lives. So this is the kind of film, really, that's not going to win any plaudits. It's not going to be on the radar for a lot of people. But the acting, the standard of acting, is top-notch. Really, really excellent acting. And it's dealing with a traumatic event that has a ripple effect, a traumatic event affecting people's lives, not just for a day, a month, a year, but literally for 10, 15, 20 years. And it's how they cope with it and how they reach peace and a resolution in their own minds. But a good film, a good solid film. And the way events overtake us, it's still in general release. And if you can catch it at the cinema, please go and see it and tell us what you think. But it is actually going on to stream this Friday. It seems to go past so quickly. You think the film's on release, and you have to be fairly quick with some films to see them at the cinema. But as we know, films have a much bigger impact on a big screen. They always will. But like I say, this film, terrific acting. You know, acting's perfect. It's superb. Morgan Freeman always puts in a good shift. So I think it's a very, very good film.
Fantastic. And I must say, I really like Florence Pugh. I've seen her in quite a few things now, and every time I see her, I'm just impressed. I don't think I've seen her put in a bad turn. If it's going to streaming, I'll probably have a chance to watch that. So that sounds good.
No, I know, this Friday. As I say, it's a film that presents characters that you don't feel pity for them necessarily. You don't feel sorry for them. They've got a kind of an edge to them. They're human, right? It's this human quality that I really like. It's like On a Wing and a Prayer, right? It just shows, right, we're all flawed, right? And it means you won't necessarily root for anyone in this film in terms of the narrative. But you gain something from it, because it's just an engrossing watch, and it shows how people deal with events in their lives.
Fantastic, and great review, Brian. Well done.
Thank you.
Okay, so lovely, not as lovely, but lovely. What's next?
What's next? Okay. I tell you why I'm laughing. It's John Wick Chapter 4. Now, you know I have an issue with Keanu Reeves. You know, I like him, and I like his films. I'll say that here and now. But I don't think he's technically a very good actor. I want to say that before we go any further. Go on, after you.
No, just every time you bring up this, it's just, I just feel the listener. I feel on behalf of the listener, you know, the
that's fair enough. You've got rage their views. Bubbling. Yeah.
No, no, it's fine. No, you carry on and create a stir, and then waddle off as if you've not done anything.
Yeah, that sounds like a plan. All right, you ready for that then, Chris? Yeah. No, I think it could be that he chooses films that don't require a lot of acting, and this, I think, for me again is the issue. Okay, look, let's look at this film. Keanu Reeves in the title role, of course. Ian McShane reprises his role as Winston, and directed by Chad Stahelski. So, storyline, the narrative. John Wick has been condemned by the tyrannical High Table. He has a plan for defeating them, but before he wins his freedom, he must face off against a new enemy with powerful alliances. That pretty much is the story. I don't think you really need to know much more about this. It's really about, as with the three previous John Wick films, it's about the combat sequences, the set pieces, the stunts. You know, there's a fair amount of CGI thrown in there, but visually it's absolutely stunning. It really is. But that's all you can really say about it. It's very competent and it's very well done. But it kind of leaves me cold slightly because we're still not seeing Keanu Reeves act. We're seeing him kill people, basically. You know, he is an assassin who's killing before he gets killed, which is what all assassin films are about, really, I think, in some ways. But hugely entertaining. But to me, I think you can get to a limit when you deal with an assassin storyline. But very good, competent, well-made, and doing good business at the box office still.
Yeah, it's got a good rating as well overall. I'm a fan of the John Wick films. I particularly like 3, actually. I thought 3 was really good. They are very much of a muchness. Like, you're watching them and you know that you're in one, and then you're not in one. Spoilers, everyone. His dog dies. Like, I can't really remember anything tangible about the plot.
I know, but tell you everything though, in some ways?
Yeah, and that's absolutely fine. And I do think these films absolutely have a place in cinema, which is, you know, you come, leave your brain at the door. You don't need to really think about the plot, and that's absolutely fine. They are also very good cinema films because often it's the spectacle that you're there for.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, as I say, the visuals are stunning. Why say I didn't enjoy it? Very thoroughly enjoyable film. The visuals are stunning. I mean, there is one scene. Have you seen it?
The 4? No, I haven't seen 4. No.
Right, well, when you see it, there's an incredible scene outside the Arc de Triomphe. And what the stunts are just unbelievable. Your mouth crushes to the floor. I think, how on earth did they do that? And as I say, I think maybe some of it is CGI. But I think a lot of it is real stunts. And, you know, you're in the hands of very skillful stunt men and stunt women who are very good at what they do. I mean, of course, he does a lot of his own stunts himself, Keanu Reeves. And
well, he's got to do something, hasn't he, Brian? If he can't act, then he's got to do something.
All right. Well, we'll have to do that podcast one day. And we'll analyse the films of Keanu Reeves.
Yep.
But as I say, he has presence and he has charisma. There's no doubt about that. But I think I'd like to see him in a film where he does acting. Take away the cars and the guns. Let's see him do some real acting. You know, that is all I would say. But I like, as I say, I like him and I like his films. And he's the same age as me, virtually. So.
There you go. But how many podcasts has he done with me? None.
No,
but you've done loads with me. Yeah, so.
Right. He's missing out, isn't he, Chris?
He is.
He's really missing out.
But Keanu, if you are listening, you can take Brian's place at any time, okay? Just let me know.
Fair enough. I will step aside for him. For one episode. One episode, I'll step aside.
Wouldn't that be weird that he comes on but he doesn't say anything? You know, he just kind of comes on and just sort of sits there. You know,
like. You could sit there in a pair of sunglasses, couldn't
and he'd be there like, I've heard what you've said about me on the podcast before. I heard what Brian said. I'm not contributing. So that was John Wick 4. Okay, we got one more?
Yeah, one more.
One more on the cinema releases?
Yeah, Assassin Club, directed by Camille Demar. Now, I've got this name wrong. I'm always Demar. Camille Demar. starring Henry Golding as Morgan and Sam Neill as Caldwell. So very briefly, the storyline here is an assassin, another assassin. And I've left these two to last for a good reason. So another assassin is given a contract to kill seven people around the world. Only he discovers the targets are also assassins hired to kill him. Oh my gosh. Well, again, thoroughly competent, very well made. I like Henry Golding, actually. I mean, he's being touted as a future Bond, and I think they could do a lot worse than cast him as Bond. But
I'm trying to think of what. Oh, he was from Crazy Rich Asians, wasn't he?
And yeah. He was also in Last Christmas with Emilia Fox.
Of course he was. Yeah.
So, you know, I think, yeah, he can act and he can do the action stuff. You know, are you watching? Are you listening, Keanu? He can act. Anyway, sorry. But look, it's again like John Wick Chapter 4. It's been very well done. It's you know what you see is what you get, right? That's fair enough. It's good entertainment, but you compare it to the reception that John Wick Chapter 4 has got. Now the reviews for Assassin Club are kind of mixed. They're not great. You know, fair enough. People have their views. But isn't it strange, though, that John Wick 4, Chapter 4, is treated with so much reverence because it is Keanu Reeves, but Assassin Club, which is a very similar film, doesn't get the same level of appreciation.
Does it operate on the same kind of technical level, though, when it comes to the stunts? Because that's what I think John Wick does excel at. I haven't seen the fourth one, but for me, that's what's really good about it.
I think probably it's not quite on par with John Wick 4 for its effects and its stunts, but it's getting there. You know, you could say John Wick is in the Premier League, and you could say that Assassin Club is at the top of the Championship, pushing for promotion, you know? It's kind of that sort of thing. But I just think it's interesting where you've got two films that, in essence, are very similar. Very similar. You've got Sam Neill, who plays Caldwell, who's the mentor, the battle-hardened veteran, and you've got Ian McShane playing a similar role in John Wick 4. So the template is very similar. Of course, Assassin Club came after John Wick 4, so you could say it's based on John Wick's sort of. But then again, we've had so many Assassin movies that what was the original template? But it's all very well done, you know, and enjoyable, but purely visual, doesn't challenge the senses in any other way. But, you know, some people might be listening and saying, well, that's fine. That's what I'm looking for when I go to the movies. And I will warn viewers, particularly fans of John Wick and Keanu Reeves. Assassin Club, I think it's probably not giving too much away to say there'll probably be a sequel.
Oh,
and that won't be a huge surprise, really.
Nah. But no. Again, no, have you got a big star in it as well?
You know, okay. You know, good, solid fare, but probably not as good as John Wick. But you appreciate the point I'm making, though, about two films that are essentially very similar.
Mm.
They get a completely different reaction or a significantly different reaction from the public because, you know, Keanu Reeves sells the film, doesn't he?
Well, I think it's like the Fast and Furious franchise. Like, you look at that film and what they've done with it, it's absolutely balmy. Yeah. And it gets, you know, front pegging for so many cinemas and magazines and all that stuff. But if you actually boil those films down to their core ingredients, they're pretty terrible. Like, they're quite terrible. Like, the acting is awful. The storyline's ridiculous. Yeah. But largely, I think it's the spectacle, I think, which people are just so drawn to. Yeah. And fair enough. You know, it's each to their own. It's like pop music, you know. If that's what's popular, then that's fine. But what I think is it's good when we do get to shine a light on these other films, especially ones that have a kinship with those types of films, because they could very much just go under the radar and you wouldn't even hear of them.
Yeah, this is it. I mean, I think Assassin Club has its merits. I would even say it's got a slightly stronger storyline than John Wick. That wouldn't be difficult. But, you know, it's got things in its favour. It's got things going for it. But again, we often come back to the same conundrum, Chris, don't we? The same mystery about how many times can you remake the same film, which is what they're essentially doing. But you know, there you go. It's an age old argument that I think we could have. But you see, the thing is, if people, you give people what they want.
give them what they want, and that's what we do. That's what we try and do. That's your cinema releases wrapped up. Thank you, Brian, for going out and about and watching all those.
Pleasure.
So I can live vicariously through you.
Yeah,
which
is
terrific. We're moving on now to the streaming pick for the month, and bear in mind a lot of what Brian has reviewed will end up on streaming, if not even by the time you're listening to this. But this was something which just went straight to streaming. The Last Kingdom, Seven Kings Must Die. And I just want to ask you quickly, Brian.
Yeah.
Obviously, you've seen this, yeah?
Yes.
But had you seen the TV show beforehand?
No, I hadn't, to be honest.
Ah, see, this is going to be interesting, because I have. So, between the two of us, we can encapsulate the entire viewership, because often when these things happen, it's interesting to find out if anyone who comes at it completely cold can still enjoy it. So I'll let you. Do you want to sum up? Should I sum up? Because if you haven't seen the original.
Oh, well, why don't you sum up and I'll jump in after
you
that.
Jump in. You jump in with all the things I miss.
Fair enough.
So the main character in The Last Kingdom is Uhtred, and he is a character of both Saxon and Viking heritage. So if you've seen the show, you'll see how he sort of is involved in the history of England and Britain, and becomes involved in all the different politics, but also the Viking invaders as well. There was quite a few series, and if I'm honest, it was quite a while ago I watched them, so the details are not exactly fresh to me. But on Netflix, there's a new film called Seven Kings Must Die, and if anyone opened their Netflix in April, you probably saw it, because it was quite a popular one on their dashboard, as it were. And in this film, we're seeing Uhtred kind of later on in his life, but a situation comes whereby a new king has come to the throne, or is about to, because of King Edward's death, and it's his son who Uhtred has a very sort of soft spot for, and he needs to protect him, because whenever there's a change of a king, there's always this sort of instability, and there's a chance that it could be civil war, could be people vying for the throne. So they need to get him crowned as soon as possible. However, there are lots and lots of different things going on, which mean there's a lot of unrest in the country, including some Vikings that have come over and are spreading kind of the idea of war and the idea of rising up against the new king to be. And the new king to be himself is also being, shall we say, influenced by the sort of religious sect that he has fallen in with, and causes problems for himself, and drama ensues. That was a very long-winded way of saying the plot, but have I missed anything, Brian?
No, that's pretty much the size of it, I think. I think this is a great choice, Chris. You know, I did see it, you know, when you scroll through Netflix, you see, oh, that was good, I'll see that. And it kind of shuffles into a kind of a mental queue in my own mind, as it does with a lot of people, I'm sure. But if you hadn't suggested it, I probably wouldn't have watched it as quickly as I did. I think this is great. This is a great pick, Chris. I really, really enjoyed this. I love history. I adore history. And this film really focuses on the birth of England as a sovereign nation. You know, this starts at the death of Edward the Elder, who was the son of Alfred the Great. So his natural heir was Athelstan. Now, Athelstan had ambitions really to be the king of a united England. And of course, as you've already described, that there all kinds of forces were at play here, particularly between the Vikings and the Anglo-Saxons. But here was an opportunity to truly unite not just England and Wessex, but the whole of England. And of course, Uhtred was a key player, because he was essentially the king of Northumbria. I loved it. I thought it was great. This period of history is so poorly documented on film for all kinds of reasons. When I watch a film about the medieval period, I can't get Game of Thrones out of my head. That's the only problem I have with it. You think, I wish I could stop thinking about the Lannisters and Daenerys Targaryen, because we know that George R. Martin drew on British history somewhere, whether it's the Tudors or whether it's whether it was Alfred the Great or whatever, but the principles are the same. You've got these warring tribes making alliances and settling scores, but it's a great piece of filmmaking. I think the battle sequences were amazing, absolutely incredible, but good film, highly watchable. And if you're a history fan as well, you'll enjoy it more.
Yeah, I think, like you say, it's not a period that's been massively covered, and not in any kind of modern sense anyway. The TV show also covers a lot of stuff that happens beforehand. Mm. And what I would say as someone that has seen the show, as well as the film, is that the film does suffer from trying to do too much in the space of a sub 2-hour film. This could have easily been 4 hours, I think. Mm. And, you know, I saw a review from someone saying it should have been a mini series, and I think I agree. I think that, or like a set of films, you could have had like a few films, because they did move on to different places very quickly. There was a lot of jumping around, a lot of, you know, and like you say, the battle sequences were really good, but they actually fit quite a few of those in that I thought they could have maybe stretched those out as well.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
It's impressive, but I think you're right, though. I think they're trying to distill too much information into what was, 2 hours, 20 minutes, I think-ish. And I think it would have been better as a series, or as you say, a series of films. I think the potential is there. But it sheds light on an exciting period of history. But, you know, I was constantly stopping. As I was watching it, I was pausing it, and I was going online to think, right, wait a minute. It made me brush up on my history a bit to try and work out what the dynamics were. But, you know, like I say, it's hugely entertaining, but it might not be for everyone. But like I say, the juxtaposition with Game of Thrones is always there for me personally. But I really must watch the series now you've mentioned that.
Yeah, I think it was a BBC thing, I think. But yeah, I might be wrong. But it was good, yeah, we enjoyed it. But it was at the same time as Vikings was on, and Vikings, I thought, was a more powerful show.
Yeah, stole its thunder a bit.
Yeah, it really did, and it kind of was, they were running simultaneously, and I think it didn't quite live up to that. But still good, and I'm glad they did this film, because actually it tied it up quite nicely, and if only it could have just maybe been, maybe even just two films, just to give it, it's like that, like Lord of the Rings, like when you watch it, you think, you need the space, you need the time. You can't fit all that into one film. Yeah, it just would never work. I think it needed a bit more of that. But I really enjoyed it. I thought it was good. I watched it in two parts, because I do. and I was really, really excited to come back for that second part. I was really into it.
It's good filmmaking. Very good filmmaking. I was impressed with it.
Fantastic. Last Kingdom, 7 kings must die. Mm. Okay. Next on, we're going to the indie films, and we actually have a trailer to listen to. So we're not going to review the film. Brian hasn't seen this film, and I haven't either. But I said to the filmmaker, we'll play a trailer on the show. So written and directed by Richie Booth. This is Outlast, and it's available on Vimeo. Apologies for the swearing in the trailer. we're now just going with expletive episode, so... If you don't like swearing, maybe skip forward a bit, but this is Outlast.
There's Aurora in the other room. Somebody heard this, Aurora.
What's that?
What the fuck?
This was a bad idea. Why do you suggest these things? Why, now I'm in here myself with whatever the fuck it is.
Right, is there anybody in this room here with me? Alone. I'm all alone. Right, please. I'm not here to hurt you. Please don't hurt me.
Listen, we just need to... One minute.
Do you hear these voices?
No, darling, listen.
No. Okay, and that was Outlast. On next to the short films, and we have two. Mm-hmm. So, have you seen both of these, Brian?
I have, yes.
You have. And thank you to the filmmakers who replied to my Twitter thread. This is where I got some great recommendations, and a few people commented, a few people DM'd me, and it was just nice to have a bit of a collection. So we'll start with the shorter of the shorts, which is A Glimpse, directed by Tom Turner. Mm-hmm. And Brian, go on with the synopsis.
Oh God, I like this. This is such a good.
It's good, isn't it?
It is damn good. If I'd have been writing a review about this, I would have given it 5 stars easily.
Ooh.
Yeah, absolutely. I really, really enjoyed this. So this is the story of a couple that meet in a bar. No, it's a restaurant cafe type thing, isn't it? So you've got Jess and Alex, and Alex is sitting there typing away on his laptop, and Jess strolls up and says, Can I just charge my phone at this table? And they start chatting. Now, what we get in the next 10 minutes is a glimpse. Here it comes. A glimpse of their future relationship, if it gets that far. And so it kind of overlaps. It goes back and forth. It actually incorporates. Now, some of the techies out there might correct me on this, but I think it includes elements of analepsis, flashback, and prolepsis, flash forward, which is very difficult to incorporate into any film, into a feature-length film. But they do it in a short. They do it because the story is going back and forth. And you see the relationship developing, and then you see the relationship hitting the rocks, and then it goes back again. And it comes back to the beginning again. And it's him having to decide whether he calls her or not, and she walks away. But all the while, it's kind of... It's going forward, it's going back, it's giving you some idea of what the highs and lows in that relationship would be if they really hooked up. And I think it's a terrific piece of filmmaking. And the director, he's one to keep an eye on, if this is what he's capable of, because I think that is damn good. And technically what he's done is very difficult to pull off in a 10-minute short.
It is, and these are the types of shorts I love. First off, it's a self-contained thing. You don't need any longer for this. It's not like a proof of concept for a longer film, which actually the one we're going to review in a minute kind of feels more than it is. And it has a very strong central idea, and it executes it very, very well. And what I loved about it was the way the conversation, their dialogue, plays out in real time. So it's just their conversation doesn't... there's no audio from these... You know, like you say, the visions of the future of what their relationship is going to be, that's all just done as imagery. But their conversation's happening. So as you're listening, you're having this very dramatic and quite cute situation of them meeting and getting over that initial awkwardness, but flirting slightly, whilst being presented with a whole relationship blossoming and unfolding and going a direction in the background. And I think what that is really smart. It's asking the viewer to do two things at the same time, which I always like. I like if filmmakers are treating their audience as intelligent. And it's also this idea of that this is what we do. If we're in a conversation, we're actually often playing these sort of things out in our heads. We're going, okay, well, if that was to happen, this was to happen, this was to happen. And I love the way they've captured that and done it with a relationship, because obviously it's emotional, it's moving. And it's also this idea that maybe within this short space of them having this quick chat, you know, less than 10 minutes, that someone's going to make a decision whether or not to, you know, act on this, based on what they think might happen, a glimpse into the future. Should I engage and carry on with this person, or should I not? Yeah. And your whole life could be completely different based on what you decide to do.
Yeah, and I think it's absolutely brilliant. I really do. You know, I think the script is excellent. You know, it gets a lot of dialogue in. You know, the dialogue in a short feature is normally very sparse, but it's amazing the dialogue they get in and the pace they maintain. It's not rushed in any way. And the script isn't overly clever. It's bright and it's articulate. But, you warm to the characters. You like them. You like the way they talk. You know, they're both very photogenic actors. They're easy to watch, easy to listen to. Got good diction. Brilliant. You know, it all kind of works. It works so well. It really does. And, you know, I can't commend it enough. It's that type of film. You know, and very rarely does a short feature have that kind of impact for me.
And also just a quick shout out to the cast, because Chris Overton as the man and then Rachel Shenton as the woman, both fabulous chemistry, fabulous performances. Yeah. I first saw Rachel Shenton in The Silent Child, which won the Oscar. It was a short film that won the Oscar a few years back.
Okay.
British film. Really good, if you can find that.
Yeah, definitely. You know, they're two actors you think, God, they should be going places, but they're just actors you vaguely recognise.
Mm. I'm not sure if I recognise Chris Overton.
They look familiar. She looked more familiar than him.
Oh, he was a producer. It was in Pride. Yeah, it was great to see Shenton again. I thought she was really good.
Yeah.
Big thank you to Rebecca Harris-Turner. She's the producer, and she got in touch on Twitter with me. And, so honoured to have seen the film, and really great to review it on here, especially being a UK film review place and watching a UK film.
Absolutely. So,
Let me just check, see if that is... Because I got a YouTube link, but I don't know if it was public. I can't remember if it was public. I think it is. Yeah, I think it is public. It's on NITV Shorts. So, yeah, you can seek that out. It's called A Glimpse. And I strongly recommend that you do. Yeah, what are you doing listening to us? Go and watch that. Yeah, it's much
100%,
better.
100%.
So that was A Glimpse. And the next short film we're going to review is The End Is Nigh.
You know, this one I found quite disturbing and quite upsetting in some ways. It was very good, very well put together, but you just feel for this vulnerable blonde girl trying to survive in what appears to be some kind of wipeout. She appears to be the only person left, and she wanders around with a bow and arrow. It's like an electric bow type thing, isn't
like
it?
A crossbow sort of thing.
Crossbow. That's the phrase I was looking for. Thank you, Chris. And she's surviving off the land, and she comes across a man who's taken her kill for the day. And he convinces her to come back to his cabin where he can cook for her. And straight away, you feel a sense of foreboding. You fear for her. You think to yourself, don't go there. And don't. But there's an essential dilemma, though, for anyone in that position, is that you don't want to be alone against the world. But you want to be with someone. But can you be with someone that you don't know and someone that you're not sure you can trust? And the plot winds quite nicely up to a conclusion, but very engrossing, and you care about the girl, you care about the girl who's defenseless and on her own. But yeah, very, very, very sort of affecting, you know, quite uncomfortable and disturbing, because you feel for her.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the father of two daughters, and watching a film like this is quite troubling for me. Yeah, the idea that, because I think she says she gets separated from her mum and her sister.
Yeah.
So that obviously plays into it. And, you know, she's 10, I think, and she's just, she's actually fending for herself. She's trying to I think she tries to fish at one point and she can't really do it. And you know, she's trying, she manages to capture a fox. Yeah. As you say, the guy comes and he's got it. And you're just like immediately going, okay, well, stranger danger, obviously. But also, mm-hmm. you're in this post-apocalyptic world, so maybe you need some help. Yeah. And it's a really weird kind of conundrum to be watching. And yeah, obviously, they go back and more things happen over there. But
yeah.
What I liked about it was, first off, it's a film that feels like it's been made with very simple ingredients. You know, they're not trying to do way too much with very little budget. And they capture this sense quite authentically. You know, the idea that you don't really see anything else. It's filmed largely in these kind of isolated woods. And aesthetically, it worked for me. Aesthetically, okay, yeah, I believe you, that's what we're watching. I found the storyline maybe a little bit kind of, as I hinted at earlier, that this was more of a proof of concept of a bigger film, that it was like, this should actually be an hour and a half feature.
Yeah, it could well be. I mean, I think, as we said previously on podcasts, that, you know, a short film can sometimes work like a kind of a testing ground. It's kind of, like you say, proof of concept. And it does feel a bit like that. It does feel like a tryout for a series of some sort. And on that basis, it's certainly got potential. You know, you're on board with the story straight away. You kind of instinctively know what's going on. So it's got that going for it as well. It's got that sense of immediacy there. But yeah, it does seem to have, you know, legs potentially, but, you know, very solid, engrossing. You get involved, you're on her side. You know, there's just no other way of describing it. You're on her side, you know, not necessarily his, but they, for all we know, they could be two people that are desperate for someone to care for, someone to look after, someone to support them, you know. So it's kind of opening up some fairly sort of basic human needs.
And you know, I've just got over watching The Last of Us, which was a series with a very similar kind of,
yeah.
Well, not that similar actually in terms of this dynamic, but the idea of, yeah, post-apocalyptic, a girl trying to survive. And yeah, it does obviously give you plenty to chew on. There's so much there, yeah. Like dramatically. And I think the writer is Nathan Sewer, who actually was the person who got in touch and asked me to add it to our list. He writes and he stars. He's the guy. And the younger lady is Chloe Sewer. I'm guessing is his daughter. I don't know. Yeah. Might be a niece, but I'm guessing is his daughter. And that obviously, I think, helps in the film because there's certain bits where it is quite intimate and maybe a bit traumatic and stuff. There's things that happen, it's not like horrific or anything, but there's just things that, you know, could be a little bit disturbing. That I think that explains that, but it's not directed by Sewer. It's directed by someone called Jamie Lynn Begley, and I think that's actually key. I've said this before on the podcast, especially with short films, when you are, you know, you have someone, maybe they want to make a film, they do everything because it's just cheaper and easier to do it. But I think if you're going to be in the film, I don't think you, and you wrote it, I don't think you should be directing.
Yeah,
or at least you need to have someone else, you know, assistant director or whatever, because no one's going to give you can't give yourself that feedback. You know, and I think that's important.
Yeah, I think you're right. You can't give yourself directions, can you, really? And you could, you know, however good someone might be, you can spread your talents a bit too thinly. Now, it might work with a big budget and you're directing and starring, but with a very tiny budget or a shoestring, yeah, it's tempting to sort of be the bottle washer and the gopher and the star. And, you know, you could do it all, but I think it works if someone else gives you direction. And that you feed back, there's that kind of rapport between director and actor that you need to capture. And I think it works better that way, definitely. So I think you're right about that.
There you go. And that was The End Is Nigh. It is, I believe, on YouTube. And it's, let me just check, it's not unlisted. Yeah, no, I think it's visible. So yeah, if you search The End Is Nigh, you'll probably find it. But if not, Nathan Sewer, which is Sewer. Hopefully I'm saying that right, Nathan. Apologies. And yeah, check it out on YouTube because I think it's worth a watch. I think it's and especially if you're into the kind of indie films and you know, maybe you're a filmmaker and you make short films, it's just interesting to see what someone's done with a post-apocalyptic world on, I would say, must be a fairly humble budget. I don't think that's a high budget film.
No, I wouldn't have thought so. But then again, though, it kind of adds to the to its value in some ways. It's aesthetic value that you're not. You can throw loads of money at a film, couldn't you? And it sometimes it won't amount to much, or it won't have much substance. But I think with this one, it shows that you can make a credible film without a huge budget.
There we go. And that was our short films and indie films that we've shone a light on. So that only leaves us with the nostalgia pick.
Yeah.
And as we've already said, it is the 1999 cult classic, although to be honest, it's more of a mainstream classic these days. David Fincher's Fight Club, based on the Chuck Palahniuk book. That was a lot to say in one go.
It was a mouthful. I'm glad you said that. Not me.
Now, when this came out, I was only 11. So I watched it as a young teen, probably a bit earlier than I should have done, at my father's kind of recommendation. My dad was big on films, and he had sort of said he'd watched this film, Fight Club, and it really stuck with him, and I should watch it. And I think that was quite telling of what my dad thought my kind of mental maturity was at that point, that he thought I could handle this film. But I did, and it became my favourite film. Absolutely love Fight Club. I wouldn't say it's necessarily my favourite film now, because I think maybe my tastes have changed, and I think this came at a time when, obviously, it's dealing with a lot of themes of anarchy and all that sort of stuff. That as a teenager, that really reverberates quite well with you. Yeah. That as a 30-something father of two with a mortgage, I'm not as anarchy driven as I was. Yeah. You know.
Well, I mean, I wasn't 11, Chris, when the film came out.
You weren't, were you?
No, I wasn't.
You were the same age as Keanu Reeves was, wasn't you?
Yeah, that's right.
I think he was 12.
Yeah, exactly. But with Fight Club, now, when you suggested it, my memory of it, because I haven't seen the film since it... I mean, I went to see it at the cinema when it came out, but I've not seen it since.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. I've not seen it since. And my memory of it was that it felt more like a style vehicle for Brad Pitt and Edward Norton. But having seen it now, I realise what a very, very good film it is. It's brilliant. You know, it's alarming, but it's also very funny in places.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, so darkly funny, yeah.
Yeah, there are laugh-out-loud moments in that film that I'd totally forgotten about. I think what makes it work, that what gives it cult status, is the fact that the character played by Edward Norton, I think it's just called the narrator, isn't he?
Yeah.
Right, that character is driven quietly insane by the routine of life. You know, he's standing there in front of a photocopier and he's somewhere else. You know, the routine of life is driving him to distraction. And I think we can all relate to that, because our lives are dictated by routines. But most of us, we just get on with it, don't we? But there are some people that can't. Some people need a safety valve, an outlet. And he starts looking for an outlet, doesn't he? And he becomes a grief tourist. And that first part of the film, I think, is just hilarious, really. Particularly when he meets Marla Singer, played by Helena Bonham Carter. The exchanges between those two are really, really funny. You know, where he says, you know, he spots her, she's a faker, he's a faker. And he said, I can't cry if there's another faker present. And they start dividing up all these grief support groups. And I just think that is just so
My funny. Favorite bit of that is when he goes, oh, like the testicular cancer, that should be me. And she goes, well, actually, you've still got your balls. It should be me.
It's a great, look, the thing is, whilst we can't trivialise what is a very serious subject, but, you know, the way it's projected, the way it's put across, it's funny. You can't help laughing at it. But you keep on thinking to yourself, I shouldn't be laughing at this, but I am. And that's the way it goes. And I think Meatloaf does a great cameo as well.
Oh, yeah, he's great. Robert Paulson.
Rest him. But he, I think, really... We don't realise what a very good actor Meatloaf was. We didn't see the best of him as an actor, but I think he did a really nice cameo. But of course, the story moves on, and the narrator meets Tyler Durden, played by Brad Pitt, on a flight. And again, quite funny the way it all starts, though, isn't it? That without giving too much of the plot away, the narrator ends up being the lodger to Tyler Durden. And this is when the Fight Club starts. They just decide to start a fight. They come out of the bar one night, they start a fight, and they realise they quite enjoy it, if that's the right word. And you think, how could this possibly grow? But, you know, I think we would have to accept that it is based on fact. These things do go on. But again, it just kind of goes into comedy mode as well. When he starts giving them homework, and he's like, go out and start a fight with somebody you don't know.
I love that.
I think that's funny as well. You know, when the guy's got a hose and he's spraying the vicar, the reverend, and he's surely, you know, get angry about it. I just think it's great. And of course, then it kind of switches into Project Mayhem, which is kind of like Fight Club going outside. And that's when True Anarchy kicks in, I guess, really. But a very, very good film. You know, you can't really knock it for entertainment value. And it is thought-provoking as well because of where the narrator starts. Because he starts off with a good job. He's a recall coordinator for a car company, isn't he?
Yeah. So
he's got a good job. He's got a nice condo that he's filling up with furniture from IKEA or wherever it is. But he's completely bored by the mundanity of it all. You know, there's so many great lines in this film. I was writing them down as I was watching it. You know, he's looking at his boss and he's saying, it must be Tuesday. He's wearing his cornflower blue tie. And you think, this is just somebody who's driven mad, really, by life being so regimented. But as I say, it's something we can all relate to, but it's something, thankfully, the vast majority of us don't fall into. But you can see his perspective in some ways. But, you know, because I think there's probably an anarchist in most of us insofar that we do wonder, we think, what would it be like to do that?
I think it's also that like sense of being unhappy with the status quo, or you go along with stuff because that's what's expected of you. Like he's expected to create an IKEA living room, and he's expected to go to that. Actually, you get swept up in that tide, and it's only when a character like Tyler Durden comes along that goes, do you know what? Actually, there's another way, and it seems so unreal at first, like what, there couldn't be another way, and that other way involves punching each other in a car park. And then it becomes more clear that actually, yes, whilst that seems extreme and seems very odd, when you start to look at the normalities of life, they seem quite odd. You know, the fact that what we do and what we do every day and what we subscribe to does start to feel very alien when you watch it in this kind of setting. And actually, when you compare it to those grief groups at the beginning, that's really interesting because you've got this idea of like people being so powerfully overwhelmed by what's going on in their lives health-wise that they're all coming together and sharing stories and crying with each other whilst everyone else is just living their day-to-day lives as normal, as if none of this is going on. And I think it taps into that. The book itself is really good. I read the book after the film, and the book is really, really powerful too. It's not that dissimilar to the film, but it's worth a read because Chuck Palahniuk's a very interesting writer. But I think with Fight Club, what I really loved about it as well was the way the filmmaking still feels very impressive, like with all of the cut scenes and the little nods of the head, the very smart. Obviously, also, we're trying to not spoil this, but this film did come out over 20 years ago, so you probably know the twist.
Yeah.
But when you then rewatch the film knowing the twist, it's like a completely different film. You watch it and go, oh, wait a minute, this actually is even more clever than I thought. And I think Fight Club is one of the very few films that can do that, and I'm very surprised you've only seen it twice, Brian. That's incredible.
Well, yeah, but see, that's the funny thing, though. I don't know why, because it's a film that I like. It, you know, I watched it. I thought, yeah, this is great. You know, this is my kind of film because of the story. It was daring as well for the late 90s. You know, to come out with a film like that was so alarming and so disturbing, but also hugely entertaining at the same time. I don't know why I've not, why it's been 24 years since I've last seen it. I don't know why that is, but I'm glad you suggested it, Chris.
Well, there we go. I mean, I'm going to do this to you now, though. What's your favourite David Fincher film?
Oh, God, no.
He has directed 94 things, so this could be quite hard.
But he directed a lot of videos, though, didn't he, as well?
Yeah.
Oh, God, that is tough.
Because you've got Seven, you've got Fight Club, yeah. Panic Room, Zodiac.
I mean, they're all great. I mean, Zodiac was brilliant. Panic Room with Jodie Foster, that was great as well. I think, really, if you're pinning me down, if you're asking me for the best David Fincher film, I think it would have to be Seven.
Seven is very good. I mean,
it's Brad Pitt again, isn't it? It's Morgan Freeman again, who we spoke about earlier on.
Yep.
You know, very, quite, I don't know, scary to start with. You know, everyone, look, on screen, right, you know, as a writer, as a director, you can kill as many people on screen. It's not real, right? It's just imaginary. But a film like Seven really had an effect on me. First of all, you think, God, that's frightening. That's scary. But it shows how good the film is. But it's that film that's gonna stay with you. Right. I mean, Seven's a film that I've watched more than once, so it's not like Fight Club, which surprises me now when I think of Fight Club. I think, right, I've seen Seven three or four times, probably. And they were made around the same time, weren't they?
Yeah.
I think Seven came before Fight Club, didn't it?
95, yeah.
Yeah. But I've seen Seven a few times, but not Fight Club. I don't know why that is. But
so I'm the other way around. I've only seen Seven a couple of times, and not at all recently, whereas Fight Club is one of those films I'll often see it on and I'll kind of watch bits of it here and there. And I watched it a lot as a kid, teenager. But both absolutely brilliant. I think they're also very much in the same kind of ballpark, like for audiences. You know, you're talking dark kind of thriller-esque films.
Definitely. And as I say, quite scary, quite challenging, but totally gripping at the same time. You can't help but watch those films. They hold your attention. And with a lot of films, you know that you think, oh, that's good, but you can pause it, you can stop it. If you're watching it at home, it's like we said before, you're watching a film at home, if you pause it, you stop it. You know, some films you can't do that. Some films you've got to stay with. Fight Club is a film I stayed with and didn't leave it. Same thing with Seven. You know, it's a film that holds your attention. You stay with it, you keep with it. If you're watching at home, because that's the real test, isn't it? I mean, if you're at the cinema, well, you've got to, haven't you, really? you can't sort of nip to the kitchen to get a lager out of the fridge or whatever. So that's slightly different. But I mean, that's always a test of a great film, if it holds your attention and demands your attention, which is what David Fincher films invariably do.
There you go. Couldn't have said it better myself. We're going to pick the nostalgia pick for next month now, because I want to give Brian time to think about it. Also, it'd be nice to let you listeners know what we want your thoughts on for next month. So do send them to us in whichever format you find easiest. You can send us a voice clip on our website, or you can tweet us or Instagram us, whatever it is that you like doing. So Fight Club is available on Amazon Prime. So if you've got Prime, you can go watch it. But obviously, it's also available generally quite easily. Yeah. But I thought this time we'll pick something that's on iPlayer, because I know a lot of people like iPlayer, and I like it too. And this is a film. I've only seen this once, and I had very underwhelming feelings about it. However, I have since been lectured numerous times by many people, and also someone even went as far as to buy me a Blu-ray of it.
Oh wow.
And I still haven't unwrapped it, which is Children of Men. Have you seen this one?
I don't think I have. That's Michael Caine, isn't it?
Children of Men. What's his name? The tall guy. What's the tall guy's name?
The tall guy. You're not narrowing the field down very much.
Come on, that tall guy. The tall guy? Come on. Oh, what's his name? Hold on. Oh, I have to look it up now. iPlayer doesn't actually have the information. It's going to really annoy me because Clive Owen.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah, I like Clovine, it's good.
It's an Alfonso Cuarón film, so it's got Julianne Moore. So, look, it's on iPlayer, Children and Men. Not really a nostalgia pick, as I've only seen it once and didn't like it, and Brian hasn't seen it. But for other people, they might feel nostalgic about this film. And it came out in 2006, so that's plenty of time for it to be considered nostalgic. And I wanted an excuse to watch it anyway. So we're going to do Children and Men, and everyone can tell me why I'm wrong and why it's the best film ever. Yeah, hopefully I've changed my mind by the time I watch this. But
well, yeah, this will be a challenge for us, won't it? Michael Caine is in the film. Julianne Moore, Clive Owen, Chiwetel Ejiofor, and Charlie Hunnam.
So you were right, it is Michael Caine. So have you seen it then?
No, I knew Michael Caine was in it. I'm very good at naming cast members, but not necessarily the films.
But are you as good at saying whether they're tall or not? Because that's what I did.
No, obviously I failed that test, didn't I?
You did.
Obviously. Yeah. No, it looks good. But no, I've not seen it, so it'll be a new one for me. So yeah.
There we go. Well, you've been listening to these Children of Men talk film for an hour. So we're going to love you and leave you, our listeners. And thank you again to everyone who shares and likes all the episodes. We have some really lovely followers, which is great. Thank you, Brian, for watching all the films and your lovely thoughts on all of them too. And to everyone else, we'll see you again next time.
Bye for now.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.